Welcome to the State of Sound podcast, produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, a companion series to the blockbuster exhibit, The State of Sound, a world of music from Illinois, now playing at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum.
Okay, welcome to the State of Sound podcast. I am Lance Tauzer. We are recording from the State of Sound studio here at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Inside the exhibit, The State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois. And today I have the distinct pleasure of having a co-host, writer and contributor Gordon Lee, all the way from the UK. Hello, Gordon.
Lance, hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for doing this. Appreciate it. And really, the reason why you're involved in this is because the case that I'm trying to make for this exhibit is that the music from Illinois has had this sort of global phenomenon and has been able to spread all over the world. And you and I know each other, and we were on a Zoom call, and I was name-dropping just about everybody in this exhibit. And when I got to Derek Carter, I could see your face change. And I realized the global impact of our guest today. And so I'm so glad that you could join us, and I appreciate you taking the time.
No, I'm thrilled to be here. I'm a massive Chicago househead, and I've seen Derek a few times, and yeah, he's a bit of a god to those of us that love house music. So it's a real joy to be here today.
All right, well, let's get him on. Hey, Derek, it's Lance. How are you?
All right. How's it going?
Good. I want to introduce you to someone who's going to be interviewing you as well as I. His name is Gordon Lee, and he's calling in all the way from England.
Hi, Derek. I have to say, I'm a big fan, and so this is an absolute honor for me to be on the conversation with you today. So.
Oh, well, thanks for turning up.
last time I saw you play, Derek, was Defected in Ibiza in July 2019. And I absolutely loved the set you put on. It was fantastic.
Oh, was that the... Yeah, okay.
Defected.
That was a good party.
Yeah, it was really good party.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, so the first thing off the bat for me is really to talk a little bit about your origins. You and I have something in common. We both are from the western suburbs of Illinois, of Chicago, I mean. So just tell me a little bit about your upbringing and, you know, your career development, and as it pertains to Chicago and Illinois.
I was actually born in California, and we moved to Chicago when I was like 3, and moved to the West Side, and then we decamped from there and moved out to Broadview when I was starting kindergarten, because I remember having to change schools. Because I had originally, when I was living on the West Side, I was going to Disney Magnet. I thought it was like the coolest school. I was a kid. We had Pancake Day. And they taught us like French and German and stuff. And we would just be like, whatever, overly stimulated, which is what I really needed, I believe, as a child. Because I was, I believe I'm kind of like still undiagnosed something. You know, I have no idea what it is, but as there's not much in the way of proper medical care for self-employed DJs, it's still undiagnosed. But nonetheless, that was always a good thing. And I ended up moving out to the suburbs and went to school out in Forest Park and Melrose Park for high school. And I went to Triton for a while when I was moving between my various classes and years of school. And then I went to UIC.
And was there anything specifically about, you know, the culture, the neighborhood, your friends, the area, anything specifically that sort of, were you the only guy doing this, or was this?
Hell no.
Okay.
Hell no.
Tell me about your peers. Tell me about how it all came together.
Between my block, there were at least 10 other cats that were DJs. There's like a local place in Maywood called Reamer's Records where I would get things. There was a place in the Coconuts in like North Riverside Mall, the JRs was in that. All that. And then there's like another place right on like 17th and Madison. There's another place on like 25th and just right across the expressway. I used to ride my bike to Baby O's on Harlem, like just Harlem and Irving by where the Sears used to be, and Rock Records and Rolling Stone and all that down there. And then
I know it well,
you know, like once I got hipped on, go downtown, go to Loop Records, go to Imports, et cetera. Even at that time, you can go to Rose Records, you know, before I'd learned about any of the wax tracks or gramophone or any of that stuff. I moved from the West Side to downtown. I got this job in October of 1987. And that was the real start to my Chicago, the roots where everything was planted for me is when I started working at Imports, et cetera. And I was ready. I was sparky.
You were on your way.
Uh-huh.
Well, Derek, what music were you playing there? Whose records were you playing?
Whatever was out, it was new, that was good. In high school, basically lie and say I was going to the library. I'd go downtown, spend my lunch money, my allowance, whatever I'd raised, mowing grass, cleaning gutters, shoveling snow, etc., and buy records. So I was buying old Trax records, Lost records, which were Trax records, various other Chicago-made things, and then like a lot of Ram's Horn imports, which were basically re-releases of disco things, like represses and re-releases of old disco things. A lot of weird independents.
And were you going to clubs as a fan, or just going to clubs as a DJ at the time? Was there a big club scene that you were involved in?
I'm very socially awkward. Probably a lot less so now, because I don't have to be like in general population. I can duck off and hide in the booth, or you know, be in the corner or something. But then I would go out, and this is a period in Chicago too where we had juice bars. So it'd be bars and clubs that weren't, they didn't have alcohol licenses. They just had like juice licenses. So I remember, you know, the Powerhouse on Michigan, like I think it was like 26th or 24th, maybe 22nd, something like that. I remember going there in high school a couple times and I saw Lolita Holloway perform there. Things like Bismarck or Congress Theater, the North Lake, which often end up being a lot of hotels with function rooms that people would throw parties in. They'd claim, you know, fashion show or some kind of cover, basically, some lie that they would tell to get somebody to let them rent a room, and they throw a party in there. Somebody show up with a sound system and some gear and bang that out. And I mean, it became kind of a thing, particularly in the suburbs, because like I had a car, but my car was for me to go to school and to work. It wasn't for me to go out partying in. Those are my parents. I had to wait to see if Rob could get the car, if Brian could get the car, or something like that. And, I mean, we'd go out and do things. There were places to go, but I was really more into the music than I was into the, like, being a punter, being in the club scene, or even, like, I would check out other DJs, but only in the sense that I thought, I would see these names on flyers. We used to call them pluggers on the promo sheets and stuff back then. And like, I'm like, oh, this is someone I've heard on the radio. You know, to me, it was a bit of a fascination. I didn't really, you know, follow anyone, or I like Farley. I mean, I like, you know, Mike Hitman Wilson, Ralphie. I've known Ralphie since I was 17. Ralphie Rosario. From my shopping at Baby O's when he worked there. Things like that. But I mainly was just trying to get music. I wanted the music. I wanted the records. You know, I wanted the power. Like, I don't want to watch everybody else with the power. I wanted the power.
See, Derek, for those of us in Europe who then grew up with Chicago House, we lived in this sort of imaginary world where we thought you all knew each other. You're all best mates. So you and Steve Silk Hurley or Frankie Knuckles, Larry Heard or Felix the House Cat, you know, people like that. You were all kind of mates together. Is that can't be true? But
to some degree, apart from any kind of like family squabbles or the natural kind of dissonance that occurs when you have a bunch of outsized personalities being lauded or given a lot of shine. One of the best things that happened with me, for me, to me, was when I was working at Imports, I kind of became like everybody's little brother. So I would Julian would make his mixes for the weekend. And I would mark the tape, like you do it on a reel-to-reel. And if you made a mistake or something happened or messed up or whatever, phone rang or mom called him or something, I would mark the numbers on the counter so that we knew to go back and do an edit there. And then, you know, get in his Corvette and drop the tape off it at the BMX studios, which are like in Oak Park, like right on like Oak Park Ave, right off the expressway, in like an old people's retirement home kind of thing, like a senior living facility. And there's a hottest radio station turning the world out in the little lobby side part. Things like that. So like, I knew everyone because I worked at the hottest record store. So whenever people would have like a big weekend, cats from Detroit, Derek May would come down, Kevin Sonson would come down. I met Blake Baxter when I worked there. Like, all these kinds of, like, new hit kids. They would all just kind of come through. I met Genesis Peorage there with his wife Paula at the time. And these, like, kind of new British folk, you know. And I gave them a bunch of acid house records that they took back and started doing like Jack the Tab and all this psychic TV stuff. This is like as they were just transitioning out of Throbbing Gristle. So I have that memory. Actually, right before Genesis passed, they sent me a message and was like, "Oh, I miss those days. And just hope everything's good with you." And I'm like, "Oh, I of course, you know." We did a show together. I traveled to New York with them once because of I had good records and was generally a weirdly funny, strange kind of cat.
Derek, you know, the exhibit here has got some amazing artifacts, and your materials that you loaned us are actually in a case that on one side of you, to the right of your materials, is Frankie Knuckles, his turntable and his reel-to-reel, and to the left of you, of your materials, Steve Silk Hurley loaned us an old synthesizer and an old sampler that he used back in the day. You know, the materials that are in the gallery are so unique from the standpoint that you know, DJs, music producers use such different tools in order to create music than, let's say, the guitars from the band Styx that are also here, as opposed to Miles Davis's trumpet, who was also in this gallery. So tell us a little bit about the materials that you loaned us for this exhibit, the CD mixer, or the digital turntable and the mixer. What were they used for? How did they help your career move along? And what sort of stories do they have to tell?
Lots of stories. The mixer, particularly, as if you can remember how dirty it was. I've had that mixer since I was probably about 20, and it was a near top of the line mixer at the time. It was one of the few times that I bought something that I felt I deserved, kind of, you know, like I often would, I'm not going to get the best one. I'm going to get a good one. Like, that's also my parents. Like, coming in, like, I don't need all the bells and whistles. Two bells, maybe half a whistle. So, that was one of the times where I was like, yo, I want all the shits. I want this to do everything. And I had that mixer for forever. And I used to do, like, in the Midwest rave scene, there were a lot of like tape vendors and this sort of thing. So, like, mm-hmm. you make mixtapes, literal mixtapes. And they would, you know, I work with a couple where I give them a master and they print up, you know, whatever they told me, plus whatever else it was, whatever. And then sell them at raves. It'd be a little kiosk at a rave. You walk in before you get to the dance floor, and they got balloons and mixtapes and then some goofy bracelets, hats, shirts, all that sort of stuff. But I used to make all my mixtapes on that. And even at a point where when I left Imports and was working at Gramophone, I would make my mixtapes that I'd sell a Gramophone, and I used to make at least two different mixes per month mm-hmm. for maybe about 3 or 4 years because they were, one was to pay my rent and one was to pay my bills and food. So I had like 6 or 7 tape decks set up and like 4 of them, I believe, were like dual recording decks. Mm-hmm. And so I could just like hit chords, set it all up, and then unpause it and then just start mixing. And then by the end of it, I'd have like, you know, 10 tapes to take to the store. I would sell them for like $15 a piece, which was a lot. I would sell them to the stores for $15 a piece.
Wow.
Back then, because I was like, yeah, you know, everybody's just so expensive. I'm like, you can have anything version of anything, but this is different. This is what I'm doing. This is, you know, and I felt like I was worth it, whatever. Plus, I need to pay my rent, whatever. Like, this is what I need. This is what I'm selling them for. Consign them. So at first they would consign them and, like, you know, hope they sold whatever. Man, those tapes would be gone like in a day or two. So then they just started giving me, you know, this, I would just do a drop. And I only really sold them at Gramophone and then like whatever, you know, I would give to rave people. But then I would see these same tapes for sale in England in like Camden. Yeah. You know, in the old days when you'd be in Camden Town, like walking right outside of the train station, right outside the tube station, on like not on the Chalk Farm side, but on the other side, it'd be like a dude sitting there with like a little cart and he'd sell tapes. And it's funny because I remember being there in, I believe, 91 or 92, and I saw some dude like selling my tape. And I'm like, yo! That's me. Where did you get this tape from? It was wild. But so yeah, I did a lot of mixes that just like, you know, even around the Midwest, like people, I still get like, you know, oh man, do you know what song 3 on the B side of Geometry is? Do you know this third track on Thoughts and Lies? You know, whatever kind of esoteric names we come up with for things. I was the only one doing them. Mark Farina was doing them as well. Spencer Kinsey was doing them. Particularly the three of us were like our own little DJ clique. So we would make tapes and just try to hawk tapes. We couldn't get gigs, especially when I wasn't old enough to work in clubs. Because, I mean, you have to be 21. And I think even a lot of this time, I was like 20 or had just turned 21. And like a party would be interesting, but clubs are regular gigs, and I hadn't aged into the regular gig club thing though. So that mixer fed me, clothed me, housed me, and kept me out of the streets, which is why I'm, even though it was dirty and it's a piece of crap now, there was no way I would ever get rid of it. It's like literally something that, you know, is a touchstone, a cornerstone, a special part of my development. And then like the CDJ, the digital turntable thing, that was one I used for some compilations that I put together, including, like, we did a Thanks for Coming By when I was running Classic with Luke, a Fabric mix that I did for Fabric Nightclub, a Choice mix that I did for this label called Azuli. It's like a Choice collection of classics. Mixed that on there. And just loads of, I mean, it was my, you know, at the time, that was also a very high-tech piece of gear. It was like the one of the first and best ways to manipulate CDs. Technics had a player that my friend Howie had two of, and it looked great. And it had this, like, you know, kind of tabletop design thing that was all groovy, but it didn't have the cueing all together and didn't have the, didn't work the jog wheel and that sort of thing. And this was like the first one that came out with that. And I was like, oh, yeah. And so that's from that series. The trouble is, I only had enough money to buy one at the time. So I had a CDJ 1000 and a CDJ 800. So it was a little, like, janky. But, hey, it worked.
It works. Hey, well, we're honored to have them, especially now that I hear the backstory of the mixer. I will have to tell you, I wasn't going to mention how dirty it was, but since you brought it up, our conservators gave it a good sorting out, and we're going to return it in much better shape than you loaned it to us.
I mean, it's never going to work again. Thank you for your commitment. I thought about trying to clean it up a bit, and I didn't really understand what this is. Some of, like, my manager's like, they want some equipment. I'm like, okay. All right, here's some I'm not using. Here's some that's sitting around, you know.
Well, It was something to help tell your story, and that definitely helps tell your story. And no, we're honored to have it, regardless if it's operable. Again, there's nothing else like it in the exhibit. I mean, there's some amazing instruments in here. There's some great awards and things like that, but there's only one mixer, so we're honored to have it.
It would be along the lines of highlighting my DJ stuff. I mean, I do production stuff. I got other things like that, but, you know, I made my bones as a DJ. And that is definitely, definitely speaking to that side of things.
Great. Gordon, you want to jump in?
Yeah,
Gordon, jump
I'm
in.
I'm going to jump in. I kind of wish I had one of those tapes from the Camden Market in 91, 92. I'm going to see if I can find any of those on eBay over here. But when you came over in that time, Derek, was that when you started to play in Europe? Or were you getting gigs? Were you old enough to get gigs then in 91, 92 to start playing house music in London?
Yeah, I came over, I got a gig at Sound Shaft in the back of Heaven. I was playing Villa Stefano in, like, Islington. I did a Kiss FM show with Bobby and Steve.
Yeah.
They, like, before, I think this is even before Kiss FM went legal. Like, I think they were still Pirate Rude Boys or something at the time.
Yeah.
And I did a couple other, like, pirate stations. But myself and a friend, Josh, came over. And what we also didn't realize is that they had got us some gigs. But it was my friend Lyndon C. And I got me some gigs, and I didn't have a place to stay. I was, like, sleeping on the floor at some Touch magazine or something in, like, Kentish Town.
Yeah.
And, like, you just can't stay on our floor, man. I was like, oh, damn. So I was able to get in the country because luckily I had an aunt and uncle who live out in Woking, or something like this at the time. And end up meeting someone who was a friend of a friend, and stayed in like Wood Green on the floor again with a lot of roaches for about a week before we had to leave again and come back home. But so I'd gotten some shows then, and it was nice to feel that kind of acceptance far away from home. And like that Sound Shaft party was forever something I will remember. So I got to drop like Charlie Colello, Sing Sing Sing, as like my sort of middle track somewhere in the set. And people like looked up at me like I was absolutely mental. And then they went crazy. And I was like, oh, suckers. You know, like, oh, I got you now. And that was really great. And then, you know, I'd done a few, I'd come over periodically. I'd get like a consolidator ticket from a friend of Ralphie's who he'd introduced me to. It's like a travel agent who'd get me these like consolidator tickets, I guess was a thing, something like $300 to get to England. And then I would hopefully make enough money when I was in England to get a ticket back home. And so it was groovy. And I wouldn't stay long. I wasn't there for like, you know, months and months and months. But I was there for maybe a couple weeks and then do some shows. But I used to be a resident at this club here in Chicago called Kaboom. And we did a, I'm thinking it was a Sunday. And some Italians came over and they were like, oh, we love you. And I was like, oh, it's nice. And then they're like, come to Italy. And I'm like, okay, I'm coming. And they literally flew myself and Mark over. And we ended up staying in Italy for like 3 weeks playing at this place called Divina Follia. And then I became like a summer resident there. So I was doing shows and getting gigs and things. You know, one of the best parts about that was they sent us tickets. And we didn't have passports, so we had to get emergency passports. And then we, like, what's the reason why you, what do you need these emergency passports for? And we're like, oh, our stepbrother, Mario, got into a scooter accident, and we want to make sure he is okay. And the lady looked at me like,
wow,
bro. What? No. So we got these goofy emergency passports and went to Italy on a lark and then ended up having a great time. And then they, you know, I would go back to Italy for the next two summers and just spend like a month in the Puglia region, like Bari, Biscaglia, that. But then driving and traveling all over Italy doing shows and just like being in Italy for, you know, a month running around Italy, which is also kind of awesome. So, you know, especially for like a kid from the suburbs who wanted to do it, to actually be doing it, you know, like to be running around Italy, to be running around England, like going to Bristol, going to, you know, all these places that you heard about because, you know, the War of 18 something or this, that, or the other, you know, like Hastings Pier and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, I had already known, like John Digweed was a friend of mine before he was John Digweed. He was J.D. Storm because he did Storm Raves. But he'd come over to Chicago a couple of times. And so when I end up back in England for the very first time, I end up going to his house and staying at his house that he lived with like his mom made me toast. You know, we were looking out the back garden, sitting there in the kitchen, eating toast points and just having like a casual conversation, these sorts of things. So there's like all this, you know, wonderful and lovely aspects to being a little kid from Broadview of the night.
Amazing.
Yeah. That's quite a culture change for you.
I always thought I was fancy. you can call it what you want. I knew I would be there at some point. I just had to figure out a way to make it happen. But literally, I was unstoppable. Like, you could not stop me.
Well, you know, you mentioned Sing 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 earlier. I just want to mention, I'm going to try to get you to come down and see this exhibit at some point, Derek. But we've actually got Benny Goodman's clarinet on display.
Oh, right on.
And Gene Krupa's drumsticks.
Oh, right on.
And so, speaking of Sing Sing Sing.
Well, there you go.
I also heard through the grapevine that you're going to be doing a gig at the Smart Bar, which is one of the coolest clubs in Chicago. You got something coming up?
Yeah, I've got a bunch of somethings coming up. I mean, the thing is, I've been a resident at Smart Bar on and off since before I was technically able to be at Smart Bar. So it's all right. I do Queen on Sundays with Michael Serafini and Garrett David. It's our queer party, gender, whatever you want to be, just don't mess with anybody. It's a party. And that's going on. We ran for 8 years and like took a year off, and now we're back. So hoping we can get another few years out of it. And that is a stone cold jam. Like, it's just a lot of fun, you know, wild kids, expressing themselves and being the person who they feel they are, but aren't always able to be normally. So it's a room full of that, set to a dope soundtrack, you know, with some lights and a lot of alcohol.
I would expect.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the projects you've got coming up? What have you got going on these days?
What have I got going on these days? Well, currently I'm reconfiguring my studio. I think when you were here, caught some of the middle of that.
I just remember you had about 1,000 keyboards.
Yeah, well.
And a really cute dog.
And Dale, I got a few of them. They're all nice. The whole thing was that I'd sort of been collecting gear since I was 17, like picking up small things here and there, and people give me stuff, like they get the new version, and you know, I'd do a favor for them or do something, I'd trade it, like, yeah, sure, let me take that. So I've had this crazy, crazy gear collection. When I moved here, I was like, I'm just going to, you know, create a super studio. Well, that's not tenable. That's not how I worked. It was more of a museum, and it started to function as such in that there was no work being done, lots of walking around and kind of like, you know, a lot of dusting. So,
I understand
that. Yeah, so I ended up like, whatever, I'm going to get rid of all this stuff. So I got rid of 75% of what was in that room. And
really?
Now, oh my goodness, that room is, I can almost pirouette, but.
Wow.
Now that everything is a tighter workspace, I'm finishing up that. I'm sorting out my audio interfaces as we speak. Hoping that I can get everything together so I can get up and running. So I got remixes to do. I just finished this project for, the Finding Cannibals came out earlier this year. It's like a thing from London. That's part of their, like, whatever it was, 25th or 30th anniversary of this song kind of a thing.
Yeah.
I did a thing for Sony for this guy, Jaden Thompson. He's a resident at Fabric in London, and he's got a hot single out. They asked if I want to do a mix. I said, okay. I have a few other things that I'm working on. I mean, I'm always working, essentially. I've got probably, you know, a couple of albums worth of stuff I need to finish, which I felt hampered before, but now I feel unencumbered. I feel free. I feel light. I flow. I got my groove back. So I'm working to try to finish that.
So when you're doing the Fine Young Cannibals, for example, when you're doing a mix for that, do you have it when they send you the record? Do you have it in your mind immediately or really quickly as to what you want to do with it?
No. They sent me the parts. So when you have all the splits, all the stems, everything's broken down. His vocal, his sax one, his sax two, his trumpet. You know, all these sorts of things. I have them all just kind of separated. It's excellent because that's kind of like how I hear music anyway, in a way.
Yeah.
I've had this conversation with people where I don't hear a song. I hear, you know, a snare that I really like. Or I hear, you know, there's this interesting little clave click that's on the eight every, you know, 16 measures or something like that. You know, whatever it is. Like, I hear bass lines, you know. Of course, it's a total composition to some, in some respect, like, you have to dig it. But I still hear music in pieces. And I think that that's probably because I reverse engineer stuff because I've always worked in music. So I listen to things like, oh, I wonder how that happened, how they got this. And then I'll, like, try to problem solve it. So, I mean, send me a bunch of parts, you know, set three or four vocal tracks, some backgrounds, and that sort of stuff. And then that's how I just kind of started trying to put it together. Like, I got all these separate things that, you know, and it was from like two sessions as well that I can string together and try to make something that people want to dance to.
And how do you bookmark all those? When you see, so if you're listening to these little songs, you listen to a song and you go, I hear that snare, I hear that. How do you say that?
My notes app is popping. My notes app is on fire. Oh, fuego, amigo. But also, I like, you know, the recorder app and things. And I mean, I'm always humming and singing into my phone. And when I'm in the car, if I'm this, like, I have a whole notes page of things that I hear in the car. And it's like, you know, there's a 2 second break with no bass line and cool congas on, you know, Tell Me That I'm Dreaming by Was Not Was. Look at that. You know, and these sorts of things where even if I'm not necessarily sampling it or looking to incorporate it, like, there's something about it I like. Like, if it's the rhythm, if it's the sound, I was listening to, like, this Linda Clifford song yesterday called Don't Give It Up. And then in the break, there's this one sound where it sounds like they're playing a bowl full of water or like a musical saw kind of. It's just really interesting. So making notes like that, like little mental notes and putting it into my notes app, or I'm actually very good with memorizing. So I'll just remember shit. Just like, oh,
that's how you don't forget passing that. That's how you kept passing those tests when you were so young. You probably had that memory.
Well, I can problem solve.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of that stuff is often context and the ability to make logic leaps, which I can do. I also really enjoy making illogical leaps, which are just fucking fun. But also, yeah. So, you know, I compartmentalize things really well. I've got a semi-photographic memory, and you just sort of stick it somewhere. And then you walk through the room that you put it in and see what's in there in a kind of roundabout way. Like, I know there are people who kind of would understand that, but it was a trick that I'd heard from someone who memorized decks of cards. And it would be to create a room, and then, you know, you can put this deck of cards, or like in a certain way, in this room. So when you walk around the room, you would see what they are and you could remember it. So it's like memory cues, like mnemonics. And So I have a ton of those in my brain. Like I have to scroll through them. And it's another thing that's weird about it, which is probably way off topic, but I meet a lot of people. It's like traveling around, like being a DJ for 35 years. You meet a lot of people. I will meet you, and if you are not where I met you before, I don't know you. I'll like meet you and like whatever. Like, wow. Like if you know, I know you from Miami and you're in Poughkeepsie, I'd be like, wait. Oh, okay. Like, it takes me, it's a very odd thing. Like, it's, you know, metadata, like GPS. It's true. But yeah, so I remember things and then I just make little notes to myself about them. And that's how I kind of keep track of at least ideas that spark up.
This explains
a lot.
This explains a lot because the mixes you put together and the sets you put together for me. You're saying you've got this. So it's clear that you've got this memory that you know where this journey's going to go. But then you throw in some stuff that's a little bit like. And I'll go back to the gig I saw you do in Ibiza, and you threw some jazz in there. I was like, okay, I like that. I don't know where that was coming from. It looked like slightly left field. Is that? It sounds like how you put things together.
Yeah. Well, because. I mean, I know I'm actually supposed to be working, but I'm also still like a merry prankster to some degree too. You know, I like to have as much fun as I can. I also want to be at the party. You know, I don't want to just have to be the DJ. I also want to be at the party. So I want to have some fun. And being that I'm in control, like I said, you know, try and stop me. I'll figure out a way to get what I want. And often, you know, especially in those situations, in Ibiza, I mean, what you gonna do? Leave because you don't like a little bit of jazz that I play? Go lay down. Go to the bar. I'll be with you in a moment. You know, it could be like that.
That's exactly what it was, and I was like, "This is really interesting for this crowd in San Antonio." But I'm like, "I'm loving it. This, come on, let's see where this goes." It was brilliant,
right? You know, and I think that was at that was that at High?
That was at Eden, but I go to High. Yeah, quite a lot,
okay. The Eden joint, it's like this. Almost seems like a band shell. Yeah. Like I'm on this little stage in front, and then the club kind of expands around and up and out. And that was also excellent because the vantage point I have, the view that I have, is the exact opposite of the view that everyone else in the club has. Everyone else in the club is looking at the focus of the lights. Like I'm here in this thing kind of lit and everyone's looking in my direction. So their view is like narrowed in a way, kind of like, I'm at the back end, at the wall of that, looking fully out. So my view is expanding. I'm seeing more than, you know, everything. I'm seeing, you know, this one girl over here who is trying something. You know, that's interesting, girl. I get it. A whole lot of different personalities and various things going on. And, you know, I'm elevated a bit, so I can see more than just eye level looking towards the stage. Because people want to look at you when they dance. Like, don't look at me. I'm not doing anything that you need to see, you know. But I like that because I look out and I'm like, so I get inspiration. I'm like, I may just play something for somebody with like a funky handkerchief on, or like you got that hat makes me think of this. I'm going to try to play this in, you know? So it's these sorts of triggers that happen just by looking at the people who are there. Like, oh, you look like, all right. I can detour for this, you know? So it's a lot of happenstance and folly.
Yeah, that's a really good happenstance and folly. That's fantastic. That should be one of your mix.
I love
that. Be one of your mixtapes, shouldn't it? All that,
right? Like, yeah. Then I'm gonna send myself this note back in 1994 and say, yeah. "Hey, bro,
But so how much of your set then would you'll start off having a good idea what you're going to play? But it sounds like you change it up depending on what the crowd is and who you see.
Yeah, that's a thing. There's always an element of how much I think I can get away with. So that I know how much fun I get to have. You know, if I can play a little disco, play a little acid, play a little jazz if I want to, play a little progressive R&B, I'd like to call it. You know, whatever, like, see how many, it's like a percentage, an odds. How many of these people are going to ride with me? And then you start feeding them a little bit, seeding them a little bit. Are they going with it? Does this not work? And after, like, you know, a little while, you can kind of, you know, tip the training wheels off and send it. So there are often things that I have which are just staple-y things, like bedrock things. Like, I can't go in there and just be a freak right away. I have to set the tone so that people trust me enough to go with me to the next record or to the next moment that I'm attempting to create or express. So sometimes those things can be a bit transposable from event to event, particularly if I know I'm, you know, this is like a club event or like a festival or, you know, a weekender or whatever it is. Like, I know I can kind of get these crowds and know where and what to kind of at least seed them with. So that may occur a bit more. But then once that's kind of done or whatever, that set, then I can go a little rogue. I can have a little bit more fun and hope that people also are having a little bit more fun. I mean, like, I view it through my lens and definitely try to get my way. But if you spend your time doing all that, who's going to call you next time? You know, nobody wants some old goofy, selfish DJ dude who thinks that they know better than everyone and doesn't care if you have a good time or not, as long as they get to hear their really cool, hip, rare records loud. So I walk that.
And Derek, how are the crowds different then? Because as I was saying to, you know, Lance, you're revered in Ibiza as a sort of a god. Do you notice a different reception between the crowds that you play to in Ibiza or Italy or Chicago? How is it different from your hometown?
Well, I know I can just about get away with murder in Chicago. Just about.
That's you and Al Capone. That's the two, yeah.
I mean, we have different milieu, but in terms of at the disco, I can be forgiven, and in a lot of other places that I play, that's not always the case. So I may have to be a little more up front, or, you know, when I play at home, for example, Chicago is, these aren't people who are on their vacation. These aren't people who've taken, you know, 2 weeks off and spent a day at the beach and now want to disco dance at night. These are people who work and they, you know, this is Friday night, but I only got a few hours because the babysitter got to leave by one, you know, whatever. Like, these, it's different considerations. You know, the nature of the place has as much to do with anything. So here, this is a proper working city. Yeah, I want to have a good time, but I also don't want somebody to just pander to me, you know, treat me like an adult. Whereas in some places, they just want you to pander to them. They just want you to give them what they want. All right, have it. And really, like, whatever, give it to them like that. So depending on how it goes, yeah, it might be a little bit more straightforward and laser focused, you know, go with a certain energy level or a, like, electronic sounds versus things with congas and real drums or whatever.
Awesome. Hey, Derek, I want to just thank you for being a part of this podcast. I want to thank Gordon Lee for all his insight.
Thank you, Gordon.
Thank you, Derek. It's an absolute pleasure listening to your backstory. And I loved all those stories, hearing you sleeping on floors in Camden and wherever and around London, traveling to Italy. It was really interesting. Thank you.
This has been the State of Sound podcast produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. To hear other episodes and more information about the exhibit, The State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois, visit musicfromillinois.com.